So we're continuing in the destiny of the individual tonight, the fifth chapter in Sri Aurobindo's The Life Divine. We're roughly at midpoint, but just to summarize briefly, if we consider that the universe could come from an asat, from a non-existence, it must be a fully transcendent that, which is unknowable and undefinable, which retains completely its freedom, and yet freely manifests through positive being, through sat. And thus, we can arrive at an existence which stands out, which is conscious, which is full, regnant, with its own power and delight. And in that regard, we see that the universe is a progressive comprehension of all that could be manifested from the infinity of that as it enters into the fields of space and time. The universe contains the individual, and the individual expresses the universe, and the individual also expresses the transcendent from which all of this comes. So if the divine retains its absolute freedom even as it enters fully and purposefully into this manifestation without losing anything of its intrinsic transcendence, nor losing anything by its complete involvement in the world, then so can the individual, because we are cognate with that. So what is possible for the divine, by definition, is possible for the individual seated in the cosmos. And so I think that's roughly where we left off last time. We'll begin tonight with the sentence, the integral view of the unity of Brahman. And we'll begin in just a moment. But first, we're reading the rich and lustrous language of Sri Aurobindo. And words have a meaning, and Sri Aurobindo chose them with a particular purpose. So tonight we'll pause from time to time and look at some of the words that he's chosen to put forward in this rolling drama, which is the Life Divine, which depicts the universal manifestation. So the integral view of the unity of Brahman avoids these consequences. That is, the belittling and degradation of both individual and universe in preference to the transcendence. The integral view. We may as well start with the word integral. Now, we've used it several times in recent weeks. It comes from the word integer, integer in the Latin, which means not to touch. In other words, to leave whole. What is integral, therefore, is what brings parts into wholeness. What integrates is that which makes the whole out of the parts. So an integral view of the unity of Brahman, by the very use of the term, means that these disjointed views of reality, what might be the Shankara's view, what might be the Buddha's view, what might be the positivist view of the 20th century philosopher, what might be the Vedantic view of the early Upanishads, all of these are going to make part and parcel of one vast comprehensive view, which is, if we can borrow the term, a perspectival, not locked into one perspective, but able to see them all. So the integral view of the unity of Brahman avoids these consequences. Just as we need not give up the bodily life to attain to the mental and spiritual. So, we can arrive at a point of view where the preservation of the individual activities is no longer inconsistent with our comprehension of the cosmic consciousness or our attainment to the transcendent and supracosmic. As depicted in his own life. Both of these states, which are considered to be antagonistic to each other, were already realized in his own being by 1909. The experience of Nirvana in 1908. Subsequently, when he was jailed in Alipur, then the immersion into the universal consciousness. So, in all cases, Sri Aurobindo remained involved in the world in an activity, even in the state of Nirvana, acting for the political liberation of India. Hardly anything could be more dynamic than that. And rising in individual sadhana in his jail cell in Alipur, all the while engaged in the experience of Vasudeva. To continue, and you might want to pay close attention to this sentence, for the world transcendent embraces the universe, is one with it, and does not exclude it, even as the universe embraces the individual, is one with him, and does not exclude him. So that, whether we see it as an asat or a sat, is a transcendent, and the universe is embraced by it. This is an idea which philosophy calls panentheism. It's a term, basically it means all is in God, all in reality is part of God's being. And is a term from Karl Krause, a German philosopher in the early 19th century, describing that the divine may be transcendent. God may be beyond the world, but yet includes the world in his own being, does not forfeit his transcendence at the same time that he becomes universal, an idea very much cognate with what Sri Aurobindo is espousing here. This is not simple pantheism. Pantheism is a term used first, I think, by John Toland to describe a fundamental identity between God and nature, God and the world. I think he wrote that in 1705. So he was commenting upon Spinoza's philosophy, natura naturans, natura naturata, nature naturing or nature natured, the idea that the divine is in some ways equivalent with the cosmos. In other words, there is some integrity between the two. The idea that there is a schism, that only the transcendent is real and the universe is a falsity or a field of suffering, is what these philosophers are working against. They have either an intuition or a deep spiritual experience that insists that all these things must be combined. There must be a whole comprehensive view of them. This is Sri Aurobindo's view. Pantheism, of course, comes in many colors, like the rainbow. And as we go through Sri Aurobindo's Life Divine, we will look at various styles of pantheism and see that ultimately Sri Aurobindo rejects none of them. But the idea of a panentheism we should keep near us, because to simply equate God and nature is too facile. It is more that the divine inheres within himself this universe. Not even coheres, but inheres. So with this idea that there is a transcendence in whom, if you like, images, spatial images, in whom the universe is floating, we come to the next sentence. The individual is a center of the whole universal consciousness. Transcendent, universal, individual. And the individual centralizes the universal consciousness. And thus, there is something valid in every ego's view that it is the center of the universe. It is a partial view, no doubt. It is stunted, no doubt. But there is a truth there. The universe, Sri Aurobindo continues, is a form and definition which is occupied by the entire immanence of the formless and indefinable. Well, we spent weeks talking about the formless and indefinable, but immanence is an idea that we haven't looked closely at. From immanare, to inhabit, the Latin means that the divine inhabits all of this world, that it's like taking a piece of cornbread and immersing it in a bowl of buttermilk. That buttermilk is the divine, and that cornbread is the universe. Does that appeal to the Southerners in the crowd? So the universe is a form and definition which is occupied by the entire immanence of the formless and indefinable. Form and definition. Rupa and Nama, the old Vedantic ways of understanding the world. Whatever comes into manifestation in the world has a name and a form, Nama and Rupa. Sri Aurobindo is here referred to it without bringing out fully that that's what he's making the reference to. So in the form and definition, that is the individual as we see it, but it's really the universe which is occupied completely by the presence of the divine, whatever you call it, the Godhead, the unknowable, the transcendent, the supercosmic, but it is not the extracosmic, to go back to the previous paragraph. It is not outside the universe. The universe is in it. So now we can go on to the next paragraph. This is always the true relation, veiled from us by our ignorance or our wrong consciousness of things. When we attain to knowledge or right consciousness, nothing essential in the eternal relation is changed, but only the in-view and the out-view from the individual center is profoundly modified, and consequently also the spirit and effect of its activity. The individual is still necessary to the action of the transcendent in the universe, and that action in him does not cease to be possible by his illumination. In other words, we attain what we call realization with what transcends the world. That does not make it impossible for us to act in the here and now, taking as valid the names and the forms before us, which we apparently occupy, and which others apparently occupy, also as expressions of the universal. The individual, pardon me, I just read that one. On the contrary, Since the conscious manifestation of the transcendent in the individual is the means by which the collective, the universal, is also to become conscious of itself, the continuation of the illumined individual in the action of the world is an imperative need of the world play. So this posits the original Vedantic view of things versus the Shramanic views of Buddhism or Advaita Vedanta later, which reject inclusion and activity in the world as a field of positive growth. To the Buddhist, it is a field of suffering. To the Advaitin, it is a field of illusion. He's suggesting here too that it is time, as he would say later in the Synthesis of Yoga, for the person who has fulfilled himself spiritually to enter into the world and, in a sense, re-energize it, to take that illumination and implant it in life, to redeem life with the value of the spiritual. To continue, if his inexorable removal through the very act of illumination is the law, then the world is condemned to remain eternally the scene of unredeemed darkness, death, and suffering. And such a world can only be a ruthless ordeal or a mechanical illusion. So if you take the spiritualist view that the world is to be denied, this is inevitable. The term inexorable, by the way, means not to be moved by entreaty, to be unrelenting, to be unyielding. So if our unyielding position is that we've got to leave the world in order to gain enlightenment, then the world is condemned to remain just what it is. And it will be either a ruthless ordeal, and ruth, by the word, way is a word that means compassion, pity. So the world will remain ruthless with our affected absence, or a mechanical illusion. And the one, of course, is the view of Buddhism, the other, the view of Advaita Vedanta. It is so that ascetic philosophy tends to conceive it. But individual salvation can have no real sense if existence in the cosmos is itself an illusion. In the monistic view, the individual soul is one with the supreme, its sense of separateness and ignorance. Escape from the sense of separateness and identity with the supreme, its salvation. But who then profits by this escape? So we have arrived at the question of identity, the nature of selfhood. Not the Supreme Self, for it is supposed to be always and inalienably free, still, silent, pure. Not the world, for that remains constantly in the bondage and is not freed by the escape of any individual soul from the universal illusion. It is the individual soul itself which affects its supreme good by escaping from the sorrow and the division into the peace and the bliss. There would seem then to be some kind of reality of the individual soul as distinct from the world and from the supreme, even in the event of freedom and illumination. Speaking to Shankara here, because, and in the same way that the Sankhya philosophy envisaged it, if there is no individual, then when the individual attains enlightenment, comes to know what it is, and if that calls you away from the world, then the world should cease. If the individual and the supreme are identical, There is an identity, a sameness, but not absolute numerical identity, right? And the same thing is true if we attain otherwise nirvana. You know, we have expunged ourselves from universal sorrow, but the universal sorrow continues on. So, let's read that last sentence again. I think I missed it. It is the individual soul itself which affects its supreme good by escaping from the sorrow and the division into the peace and the bliss. There would seem then to be some kind of reality of the individual soul as distinct from the world and from the supreme, even in the event of freedom and illumination. But for the illusionist, the individual soul is an illusion and non-existent except in the inexplicable mystery of Maya. So we're back to Shankara here. Therefore, we arrive at the escape of an illusory non-existent soul from an illusory non-existent bondage and an illusory non-existent world as the supreme good which that non-existent soul has to pursue. So if in the first case, the individual is a fiction in a moving universe. In this case, there's no universe anyway. There's no soul. So who is it that's going to be freed? In both cases, you can ask that question. And the answer is, I don't know. Therefore, we arrive at the escape of an illusion. Oh, pardon me. I'm going through that again. Tonight I had the tendency to repeat myself. For this is the last word of the knowledge. There is none bound, none freed, none seeking to be free. This is actually a citation from Gaudapada commenting on the Mandukya Upanishad, and it's 2.32 through 35 in his commentary. And he was the preceptor, we guess, to Shankara. So that idea that there is no soul to be bound, no soul to be freed, and none seeking to be free is seminal to his stance. It's world denying, saying only Brahman exists. That is the truth, and the world is a lie. I think I just conflated Gaudapada and Shankara, and I beg your pardon for it. Vidya turns out to be as much a part of the phenomenal as avidya. This again is a reference to those passages from the Isha Upanishad which we've looked at earlier. It's also an echo of the Madhyamika philosophy of Nagarjuna in Buddhism. Vidya turns out to be as much a part of the phenomenal as avidya. Nirvana is samsara. Samsara is nirvana. There's no way to separate the two. Maya, Sri Aurobindo continues, meets us even in our escape and laughs at the triumphant logic which seemed to cut the knot of her mystery. These things, it is said, cannot be explained. They are the initial and insoluble miracle. They are for us a practical fact and have to be accepted. We have to escape by a confusion out of a confusion. The individual soul can only cut the knot of ego by a supreme act of egoism, an exclusive attachment to its own individual salvation, which amounts to an absolute assertion of its separate existence in Maya. We are led to regard other souls as if they were figments of our mind, and their salvation unimportant. Our soul alone, as if it were entirely real, and its salvation the one thing that matters. I come to regard my personal escape from bondage as real, while other souls who are equally myself remain behind in the bondage. And here, obviously, he is lampooning both Advaita Vedanta and Theravada Buddhism. You might also say, again, this is another reference to the Sankhya problem, which if the Purusha becomes free, then aren't all Purushas freed? If one Purusha can divorce itself from Prapati, then why aren't all? It is only when we put aside all irreconcilable antinomy between self and the world that things fall into their place by a less paradoxical logic. Antinomy, because the word means contradiction in law. So there's an inbuilt fallacy here. The idea is self-contradictory. We're going to take up a spiritual path which will lead us to salvation, but we don't really exist. There is no you there, but we want to free you. We must accept the many-sidedness of the manifestation, even while we assert the unity of the manifested. And is this, and is not this, after all, the truth that pursues us wherever we cast our eyes, unless seeing we choose not to see? Is not this, after all, the perfectly natural and simple mystery of conscious being, that it is bound neither by its unity nor by its multiplicity? It is absolute in the sense of being entirely free to include and arrange in its own way all possible terms of its self-expression. There is none bound, none freed, none seeking to be free, for always that is a perfect freedom. It is so free that it is not even bound by its liberty. It can play at being bound without incurring a real bondage. Its chain is a self-imposed convention, its limitation in the ego a transitional device that it uses in order to repeat its transcendence and universality in the scheme of the individual Brahman. Tat dvam asi, you are that, Chandogya Upanishad. The idea that we could ever be eternally locked into a limited form misses the whole point of the manifestation. It is a free manifestation, an entrance of a limitless divinity by intention, by design, deliberately, into the limitation of form, because even the cosmos, vast as it is a limitation in form. And then to stand individually within that vastness as well. And to take that so that this progressive comprehension of various aspects of its being can be attained, that its ultimate unity can be regained through the multiplicity, because this is a progressive manifestation, and that its enchainment is what is illusory, because it's a limited snapshot of what is a motion picture. To miss that is to miss entirely the meaning behind the cosmos. You've really abandoned all the delight that is implanted in the world if you think that is what we should do. The transcendent, the supracosmic, is absolute and free in itself, beyond time and space and beyond the conceptual opposites of finite and infinite. So now he begins a recapitulation of what his position is. But in cosmos, It uses its liberty of self-formation. It's Maya, and Maya, remember, means really to compress, to finitize, to take what is immeasurable and measure it out. It's Maya to make a scheme of itself in the complementary terms of unity and multiplicity. And this multiple unity it establishes in the three conditions of the subconscient, the conscient, and the superconscient. So we'll be meeting these terms often through the rest of the Life Divine. This is their first instance here. For actually, we see that the many objectivized in form in our material universe start with a subconscious unity, which expresses itself openly enough in cosmic action and cosmic substance, but of which they are not themselves superficially aware. Because to be subconscious means to be below the line of consciousness. And so what is subconscious would not be aware of the coexistence of all, of the commonality of all, of the immanence of all. In the conscient, he continues, the ego becomes the superficial point at which the awareness of unity can emerge. Not that every egoistic individual is aware of the context or the vast, but they can become aware of it at that point. Again, suggesting, implying that there is a progression from the subconscious to the conscient, and that field of progression, that path of progression, he will later call evolution. But it applies its perception of unity to the form and surface action, and failing to take account of all that operates behind, fails also to realize that it is not only one in itself, but one with others. This limitation of the universal I in the divided ego sense constitutes our imperfect individualized personality. But when the ego transcends, remember what transcends means, to go beyond. When the ego transcends the personal consciousness, it begins to include and be overpowered by that which is to us superconscious. So a grade of consciousness awaits our arrival as we graduate from the egoistic. And he's carefully constructed this sentence. It begins to include, so you experience it, you begin to include, it overwashes you, you feel overpowered by that superconsciousness. Semicolon, it becomes aware of the cosmic unity and enters into the transcendent self, which here cosmos expresses by a multiple oneness. And he's suggesting that you can get to the complete state. The experience leads to the constant awareness. We call that realization. You're engaged in the transcendence at that point. Yourself has been restored to what it was originally before it entered into the field of time and became the ego. And that transcendence, that self, expresses itself in the cosmos as a multiple oneness. You are now universalized, but also transcendent. You live and walk continually in this individual encasement. And yet, you are a cosmic person. And yet, you are that thing which is beyond cosmos. You are that thing which is beyond even being, which is undefinable, unrealizable. You have come from that, entered into the mystery of the universe, and transcended and gone back, and yet still you are here, just like the divine does. This is yoga. This is the complete yoga. So, and in this next paragraph, Sri Aurobindo really shows that the individual is a key to the cosmos. The liberation of the individual soul is therefore the keynote of the definitive divine action. It is the primary divine necessity and the pivot on which all else turns. It is the point of light at which the intended complete self-manifestation in the many begins to emerge. But the liberated soul extends its perception of unity horizontally as well as vertically. That liberated soul counts for the cosmos. Its unity with the transcendent one is incomplete without its unity with the cosmic many. We must have both. We must be fully engaged with our arms around the universe, even as we live in a transcendent awareness. And that lateral unity translates itself by a multiplication, a reproduction of its own liberated state at other points in the multiplicity. There is a power inherent in the realization which wants to extend itself. One person enlightened has a power to illuminate others if they are receptive. And I'll always remember how M.P. Pundit phrased this. You know, an enlightened being is one who is like a roaring fire. And there are logs nearby. Those nearest, which are dry, also catch fire. Those which are further off, but which are damp, get dry. Become ready. The divine soul reproduces itself in similar liberated souls as the animal reproduces itself in similar bodies. The light spreads wide. Therefore, whenever even a single soul is liberated, there is a tendency to an extension and even to an outburst of the same divine consciousness in other individual souls of our terrestrial humanity, and who knows, perhaps even beyond the terrestrial consciousness. So one who has this power of enlightenment, if he finds one into whom that consciousness can be transferred, it's like reproduction. This goes back to that idea, Vedantic idea, that there is a spiritual father and a spiritual son. Spiritual mother, spiritual daughter, and on and on. And these things are transferred almost in a familial way and can reach out and out and out and form lines of connected points of illumination. That old idea, a thousand points of light. But it's a web of light, isn't it? It may begin with one. But where shall it end? Sri Aurobindo suggests that this counts when we achieve this. Does this power not reach beyond terra firma? Does it not reach into regions where beings may be stuck in positions in other stadia of the universe? In heavens, where they would dearly love to be freed, in hells, where they would love to have a drink of water? Does this power of illumination not become universal if universally it is held? It is a power that pervades all. And so, this idea that the gods rejoice when anyone achieves illumination is an old and important mystic truth. It is an insight because it is so pivotal for something to occur here of that magnitude that all the inner worlds are affected by it. We change the future for everything when we change our present. And if we live in eternity, rather than as captives of the moment, as prisoners of a partial view of things, you can see what it leads us to. Where shall we fix the limit of that extension? Is it altogether a legend which says of the Buddha that as he stood on the threshold of nirvana, of the non-being, his soul turned back and took the vow never to make the irrevocable crossing so long as there was a single being upon earth undelivered from the knot of the suffering, from the bondage of the ego? Well, there is no record in the Pali of the Buddha ever having said that. It is the vow of the Bodhisattva some centuries later in the developing Mahayana tradition, which asserts that, quote, I will not accept nirvana into myself until every sentient being, every blade of grass is enlightened before me. Such a wonderful, beautiful idea it is, end quote, earlier. But this is part of the Mahayana tradition, centuries, maybe even a millennium after Buddha had come and gone. Buddha had a rich and beautiful teaching, which we've spoken about earlier. It is unclear as to whether Sri Aurobindo had volumes on Buddhism close to his reach at this stage in 1914 in Pondicherry. He had a limited library that he was working with, and it would be later that that library would expand, in fact, into the 20s and 30s, etc. So he had to work from the information that he had. And remember, at this period, scholarship in Vedanta, in Indian thought in general, and in Buddhism was just beginning to get raised up to a level where it was making appreciable attainment. The scholarship actually had been rather poor in the 19th century. By the teens in the 20s, new works were coming into publication in the Sanskrit. We can be pretty sure that Sri Aurobindo had a good stock of material relating to Advaita Vedanta, and he studied Shankara pretty closely. He understood those arguments even in the Sanskrit. We can't say that his understanding of all schools of Vedanta was equally close. He never had the chance to look, so far as we can see, at Kashmir Shaivism, which bore, ironically, a close resemblance to some aspects of his philosophy. That's a pity. So, as we go through here, from time to time, we'll stop and we'll see that there's maybe a quotation or a citation which is somewhat fuzzy, and we'll draw attention to that. It's only fair. So Sri Aurobindo continues, but we can attain to the highest without blotting ourselves out from the cosmic extension. Brahman preserves always its two terms of liberty within and of formation without, of expression and of freedom from the expression. We also, being that, can attain to the same divine self-possession. There it is, this connection between what we may achieve, representing the divine within the cosmos as it achieves it, standing both outside and in the cosmos, from inside and from outside. And who is achieving it? It is really that divine which is achieving. That is the only reality, no? We have agreed. The harmony of the two tendencies is the condition of all life that aims at being really divine. Liberty, pursued by exclusion of the thing exceeded, leads along the path of negation to the refusal of that which God has accepted. Activity, pursued by absorption in the act and the energy, leads to an inferior affirmation and the denial of the highest. This goes back to the motto which opened the chapter, quoted from the Isha Upanishad. But what God combines and synthesizes, wherefore should man insist on divorcing? To be perfect as he is perfect is the condition of his integral fulfillment. So to back up, the vidya and the avidya cited from the Isha Upanishad, the term synthesize, that is the correct form of the verb. It means to flow together, to place together, to combine. And this idea to be as perfect as he is perfect in the condition of his integral attainment, we find that not only in the Vedanta, in some passages in the Upanishad, but quite directly spoken about in the Bhagavad Gita. Is integral attainment, not fractional. We are leaving nothing out in an integral attainment. Yes, we demand our soul will not be satisfied until we have resumed that transcendent poise which was our origination. We won't be satisfied until that quest is complete. But we won't be satisfied until we have brought back that freedom and that power of consciousness and made the body feel it, made matter feel its impact, so that it can know that it has been embraced and redeemed by that same Supreme. And his last paragraph in this chapter. Through avidya, the multiplicity, lies our path out of the transitional egoistic self-expression in which death and suffering predominate. Through avidya, through the multiplicity, by not rejecting it, that's how we really fulfill. Through vidya, consenting with avidya by the perfect sense of oneness even in that multiplicity, we enjoy integrally the immortality and the beatitude. By attaining to the unborn beyond all becoming, we are liberated from this lower birth and death. By accepting the becoming freely as the divine, we invade mortality with the immortal beatitude and become luminous centers of its conscious self-expression in humanity. What questions have you? Mm-hmm. Namaste. Jai Ma. We'll go for our meditation now. Mm-hmm.